The boy, he said.
Yes.
Why?
I'll pay you for him, I said. I can have money wired.
Money, Osef said. He tittered.
Have you ever heard of Rockingham, West Australia, a slice of heaven? You should see it. Miles and miles of beach. Green water, blue skies. My parents live there, in a beachfront villa. There's a golf course behind a villa and a little lake. Father plays golf every day. Mother, she prefers tennis. And father says she has a wicked backhand. They own an Afghan restaurant and two jewelry stores. Both businesses are doing spectacularly. He plucked the red grape, put it, lovingly, in Sohrab's mouth. So if I need money, I'll have them wire it to me. He kissed the side of Sohrab's neck. The boy flinched a little, closed his eyes. Besides, I didn't fight the Shorawi for money. Didn't join the Taliban for money either. Do you want to know why I joined them? My lips had gone dry. I licked them and found my tongue had dried too. Are you thirsty? Osef said, smirking. No. I think you're thirsty. I'm fine, I said. The truth was, the room felt too hot suddenly. Sweat was bursting from my pores, prickling my skin. And was this really happening? Was I really sitting across from Osef?
As you wish, he said. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes, how I joined the Taliban. Well, as you may remember, I wasn't much of a religious type. But one day, I had an epiphany. I had it in jail. Do you want to hear?
I said nothing.
Good, I'll tell you, he said. I spent some time in jail at Policharchi just after Babrak Karmal took over in 1980. I ended up there one night when a group of Parchami soldiers marched into our house and ordered my father and me at gunpoint to follow them. The bastards didn't give a reason, and they wouldn't answer my mother's questions. Not that it was a mystery. Everyone knew the communists had no class. They came from poor families with no name. The same dogs who weren't fit to lick my shoes before the Shorawi came were now ordering me at gunpoint, Parchami flag on their lapels, making their little point about the fall of the bourgeoisie and acting like they were the ones with class. It was happening all over. Round up the rich, throw them in the jail, make an example for the comrades. Anyway, we were crammed in groups of six in these tiny cells, each the size of a refrigerator. Every night, the commandant, a half Hazara, half Uzbek thing who smelled like a rotting donkey, would have one of the prisoners dragged out of the cell and he'd beat him until sweat poured from his fat face. Then he'd light a cigarette, crack his joints, and leave. The next night, he'd pick someone else. One night, he picked me. It couldn't have come at a worse time. I'd been peeing blood for 3 days. Kidney stones. And if you've never had one, believe me when I say it's the worst imaginable pain. My mother used to get them too, and I remember she told me once she'd rather give birth than pass a kidney stone. Anyway, what could I do? They dragged me out, and he started kicking me. He had knee-high boots with steel toes that he wore every night for his little kicking game, and he used them on me. I was screaming, and he kept kicking me, and then, suddenly, he kicked me on the left kidney, and the stone passed. Just like that. Oh, the relief. Osef laughed. And I yelled, Allahu Akbar. And he kicked me even harder, and I started laughing. He got mad and hit me harder. And the harder he kicked me, the harder I laughed. They threw me back in the cell laughing. I kept laughing and laughing because suddenly I knew that had been a message from God. He was on my side. He wanted me to live for a reason. You know, I ran into that commandant on the battlefield a few years later. Funny how God works. I found him in a trench just outside Maimana, bleeding from a piece of shrapnel in his chest. He was still wearing those same boots. I asked him if he remembered me. He said no. I told him the same thing I just told you.
that I never forget a face. Then I shot him in the balls. I've been on a mission since. What mission is that? I heard myself say. Stoning adulterers? Raping children? Flogging women for wearing high heels? Massacring Hazaras? All in the name of Islam? The words spilled suddenly and unexpectedly, came out before I could yank the leash. I wished I could take them back, swallow them, but they were out. I had crossed the line, and whatever little hope I had of getting out alive had vanished with those words. A look of surprise passed across Asef's face, briefly, and disappeared. "I see this may turn out to be enjoyable after all," he said, snickering. "But there are things traitors like you don't understand."
"Like what?" I said.
Asef's brow twitched.
"Like pride in your people, your customs, your language. Afghanistan is like a beautiful mansion littered with garbage, and someone has to take out the garbage."
"That's what you were doing in Mazar, going door to door, taking out the garbage," I said.
"Precisely."
"In the West, they have an expression for that," I said. "They call it ethnic cleansing."
"Do they?"
Asef's face brightened. "Ethnic cleansing. I like it. I like the sound of it."
"All I want is the boy," I said.
"Ethnic cleansing," Asef murmured, tasting the words.
"I want the boy," I said again.
Sohrab's eyes flicked to me. They were slaughter sheep's eyes. They even had the mascara. I remembered how, on the day of Eid of Qurban, the mullah in our backyard used to apply mascara to the eyes of the sheep and feed it a cube of sugar before slicing its throat. I thought I saw pleading in Sohrab's eyes.
"Tell me why," Asef said.
He pinched Sohrab's earlobe between his teeth, let go. Sweat beads rolled down his brow.
"That's my business," I said.
"What do you want to do with him?" he said. Then a coy smile. "Or to him?"
"That's disgusting," I said.
"How would you know? Have you tried it?"
"I want to take him to a better place," I said.
"Tell me why."
"That's my business," I said.
I didn't know what had emboldened me to be so curt. Maybe the fact that I thought I was going to die anyway.
"I wonder," Asef said. "I wonder why you've come all this way, Emir. Come all this way for a Hazara. Why are you here? Why are you really here?"
"I have my reasons," I said.
"Very well then," Asef said, sneering.
He shoved Sohrab in the back, pushed him right into the table. Sohrab's hips struck the table, knocking it upside down and spilling the grapes. He fell on them, face first, and stained his shirt purple with grape juice. The table's legs, crossing through the ring of brass balls, were now pointing to the ceiling.
"Take him, then," Asef said.
I helped Sohrab to his feet, swatted the bits of crushed grape that had stuck to his pants like barnacles to a pier.
"Go, take him," Asef said, pointing to the door.
I took Sohrab's hand. It was small, the skin dry and calloused. His fingers moved and laced themselves with mine. I saw Sohrab in that Polaroid again, the way his arm was wrapped around Hassan's leg, his head resting against his father's hip. They had both been smiling. The bells jingled as we crossed the room. We made it as far as the door.
"Of course," Asef said behind us. "I didn't say you could take him for free."
I turned. "What do you want?"
"You have to earn him."
"What do you want?" I said.
"We have some unfinished business, you and I," Asef said. "You remember, don't you?"
He need not have worried. I would never forget the day after Dawood Khan overthrew the king. My entire adult life, whenever I heard Dawood Khan's name, what I saw was Hassan with his slingshot pointed at Asef's face. Hassan saying that they would have to start calling him One-Eyed Asef instead of Asef Gushkhor. I remember how envious I had been of Hassan's bravery. Asef had backed down. and promised that in the end he would get us both. He had kept that promise with Hassan, and now it was my turn. "All right," I said, not knowing what else there was to say. I wasn't about to beg. That would have only sweetened the moment for him. Asif called the guards back into the room. "I want you to listen to me," he said to them. "In a moment, I'm going to close the door. Then he and I are going to finish an old bit of business. No matter what you hear, don't come in. Do you hear me? Don't come in." The guards nodded, looked from Asif to me. "Yes, Ahasib. When it's all done, only one of us will walk out of this room alive," Asif said. "If it's him, then he's earned his freedom and you let him pass. Do you understand?" The older guard shifted on his feet. "But, Ahasib, if it's him, you let him pass," Asif screamed. The two men flinched, but nodded again. They turned to go. One of them reached for Sohrab. "Let him stay," Asif said. He grinned. "Let him watch. Lessons are good things for boys." The guards left. Asif put down his prayer beads, reached in the breast pocket of his black vest. What he fished out of that pocket did not surprise me one bit. Stainless steel brass knuckles. He has gel in his hair and a Clark Gable mustache above his thick lips. The gel has soaked through the green paper surgical cap and made a dark stain the shape of Africa. I remember that about him. That on the gold Allah chain around his dark neck. He is peering down at me, speaking rapidly in a language I don't understand. Urdu, I think. My eyes keep going to his Adam's apple bobbing up and down, up and down, and I want to ask him how old he is anyway. He looks far too young, like an actor from some foreign soap opera. But all I can mutter is, "I think I gave him a good fight. I think I gave him a good fight." I don't know if I gave Asif a good fight. I don't think I did. How could I have? That was the first time I had fought anyone. I had never so much as thrown a punch in my entire life. My memory of the fight with Asif is amazingly vivid in stretches. I remember Asif turning on the music before slipping on his brass knuckles. The prayer rug, the one with the oblong woven mecca, came loose from the wall at one point and landed on my head. The dust from it made me sneeze. I remember Asif shoving grapes in my face, his snarl all spit-shining teeth, his bloodshot eyes rolling. His turban fell at some point and let loose curls of shoulder-length blonde hair. And the end, of course. That I still see with perfect clarity. I always will. Mostly, I remember this. His brass knuckles flashing in the afternoon light. How cold they felt with the first few blows, and how quickly they warmed with my blood. Getting thrown against the wall. A nail where a framed picture may have hung once, jabbing at my back. Sohrab screaming. Tabla, harmonium, a del roba. Getting hurled against the wall. The knuckles shattering my jaw, choking on my own teeth, swallowing them, thinking about all the countless hours I had spent flossing and brushing, getting hurled against the wall. Lying on the floor, blood from my split upper lip staining the mauve carpet, pain ripping through my belly and wondering when I would be able to breathe again. The sound of my ribs snapping like the tree branches Hassan and I used to break to sword fight like Sinbad in those old movies. Sohrab screaming, the side of my face slamming against the corner of the television stand. That snapping sound again, this time just under my left eye. Music, Sohrab screaming, fingers grasping my hair, pulling my head back, the twinkle of stainless steel. Here they come. That snapping sound yet again, now my nose. Biting down in pain, noticing how my teeth did not align like they used to. Getting kicked, Sohrab screaming. I don't know at what point I started laughing, but I did. It hurt to laugh, hurt my jaws, my ribs, my throat. But I was laughing and laughing. And the harder I laughed, the harder he kicked me, punched me, scratched me. "What's so funny?" Osef kept roaring with each blow. His spittle landed in my eye. Sohrab screamed. "What's so funny?" Osef bellowed. Another rib snapped, this time left lower. What was so funny was that, for the first time since the winter of 1975, I felt at peace. I laughed because I saw that in some hidden nook in a corner of my mind, I had even been looking forward to this. I remembered the day on the hill I had pelted Hassan with pomegranates and tried to provoke him. He had just stood there, doing nothing, red juice soaking through his shirt like blood. Then he had taken the pomegranate from my hand, crushed it against his forehead. "Are you happy now?" he had hissed. "Do you feel better?" I hadn't been happy, and I hadn't felt better. Not at all. But I did now. My body was broken. Just how badly, I would not find out until later. But I felt healed. Healed at last. I laughed. Then, the end. That I'll take to my grave. I was on the ground laughing, Osef straddling my chest, his face a mask of lunacy framed by snarls of his hair swaying inches from my face. His free hand was locked around my throat. The other, the one with the brass knuckles, cocked above his shoulder. He raised his fist higher, raised it for another blow. Then, "Bas," a thin voice. We both looked. "Please, no more." I remembered something the orphanage director had said when he had opened the door to me and Farid. What had been his name? Zaman? "He's inseparable from that thing," he had said. "He tucks it in the waist of his pants everywhere he goes." "No more," Sohrab said. Twin trails of black mascara, mixed with tears, had rolled down his cheeks and smeared the rouge. His lower lip trembled. Mucus seeped from his nose. "Bas," he croaked. His hand was cocked above his shoulder, holding the cup of the slingshot at the end of the elastic band which was pulled all the way back. There was something in the cup, something shiny and yellow. I blinked the blood from my eyes and saw it was one of the brass balls from the ring in the table base. Sohrab had the slingshot pointed to Osef's face. "No more, Aga, please," he said, his voice husky and trembling. "Stop hurting him." Osef's mouth moved wordlessly. He began to say something and stopped. "What do you think you're doing?" he finally said. "Please stop," Sohrab said, fresh tears pooling in his green eyes, mixing with mascara. "Put it down, Hazara," Osef said. "Put it down, or what I'm doing to him will be a gentle ear-twisting compared to what I'll do to you." The tears broke free. Sohrab shook his head. "Please, Aga," he said. "Stop. Put it down. Don't hurt him anymore. Put it down. Please. Put it down. Bas. Put it down." Osef let go of my throat and lunged at Sohrab. The slingshot made a sound when Sohrab released the cup. Then Osef was screaming. He put his hand where his left eye had been just a moment ago. Blood oozed between his fingers. Blood and something else, something white and gel-like. That's called vitreous fluid, I thought with clarity. I've read that somewhere, vitreous fluid. Osef rolled on the carpet, rolled side to side, shrieking, his hand still cupped over the bloody socket. "Let's go," Sohrab said. He took my hand, helped me to my feet. Every inch of my battered body wailed with pain. Behind us, Osef kept shrieking, "Out! Get it out!" Teetering, I opened the door. The guards' eyes widened when they saw me, and I wondered what I looked like. My stomach hurt with each breath. One of the guards said something in Pashto, and then they blew past us, running into the room where Asif was still screaming, "Out!" "Bia," Sohrab said, pulling my hand. "Let's go." I stumbled down the hallway, Sohrab's hand in mine. I took a final look over my shoulder. The guards were huddled over Asif, doing something to his face. Then I understood. The brass ball was still stuck in his empty eye socket. The whole world rocking up and down, swooping side to side, I hobbled down the steps, leaning on Sohrab. From above, Asif's screams went on, the cries of a wounded animal. We made it outside, into daylight, my arm around Sohrab's shoulder, and I saw Farid running toward us. "Bismillah, Bismillah," he said, eyes bulging at the sight of me. He slung my arm around his shoulder and lifted me, carried me to the truck, running. I think I screamed. I watched the way his sandals pounded the pavement, slapped his black calloused heels. It hurt to breathe. Then I was looking up at the roof of the Land Cruiser and the back seat, the upholstery beige and ripped, listening to the ding, ding, ding signaling an open door. Running footsteps around the truck. Farid and Sohrab exchanging quick words. The truck's door slammed shut and the engine roared to life. The car jerked forward and I felt a tiny hand on my forehead. I heard voices on the street, some shouting, and saw trees blurring past in the window. Sohrab was sobbing. Farid was still repeating, "Bismillah, Bismillah." It was about then that I passed out. Faces poke through the haze, linger and fade away. They peer down and ask me questions. They all ask questions. Do I know who I am? Do I hurt anywhere? I know who I am, and I hurt everywhere. I want to tell them this, but talking hurts. I know this because some time ago, maybe a year ago, maybe two, maybe 10, I tried to talk to a child with rouge on his cheeks and eyes smeared black. The child. Yes, I see him now. We are in a car of sorts, the child and I. And I don't think Surayya's driving, because Surayya never drives this fast. I want to say something to this child. It seems very important that I do. But I don't remember what I want to say, or why it might have been important. Maybe I want to tell him to stop crying, that everything will be all right now. Maybe not. For some reason I can't think of, I want to thank the child. Faces. They're all wearing green hats. They slip in and out of view. They talk rapidly, use words I don't understand. I hear other voices, other noises, beeps and alarms, and always more faces, peering down. I don't remember any of them, except for the one with the gel in his hair and the Clark Gable mustache, the one with the Africa stain on his cap, Mr. Soap Opera Star. That's funny. I want to laugh now, but laughing hurts too. I fade out. She says her name is Aisha, like the Prophet's wife. Her graying hair is parted in the middle and tied in a ponytail, her nose pierced with a stud shaped like the sun. She wears bifocals that make her eyes bug out. She wears green too, and her hands are soft. She sees me looking at her and smiles, says something in English. Something is jabbing at the side of my chest. I fade out. A man is standing at my bedside. I know him. He is dark and lanky, has a long beard. He wears a hat. What are those hats called? Pakols? Wears it tilted to one side like a famous person whose name escapes me now. I know this man. He drove me somewhere a few years ago. I know him. There's something wrong with my mouth. I hear a bubbling sound. I fade out. My right arm burns. The woman with the bifocals and sun-shaped stud is hunched over my arm, attaching a clear plastic tubing to it. She says it's the potassium. It stings like a bee, no? She says. It does. What's her name? Something to do with a prophet. I know her too from a few years ago. She used to wear her hair in a ponytail. Now it's pulled back, tied in a bun. Soraya wore her hair like that the first time we spoke. When was that? Last week? Aisha, yes. There's something wrong with my mouth, and that thing jabbing at my chest. I fade out. We are in the Sulaiman Mountains of Baluchistan, and Baba is wrestling the black bear. He is the Baba of my childhood, Tufan Agha, the towering specimen of Pashtun might, not the withered man under the blankets, the man with the sunken cheeks and hollow eyes. They roll over a patch of green grass, man and beast, Baba's curly brown hair flying. The bear roars, or maybe it's Baba. Spittle and blood fly, claw and hand swipe. They fall to the ground with a loud thud, and Baba is sitting on the bear's chest, his fingers digging in its snout. He looks up at me and I see. He's me. I'm wrestling the bear. I wake up. The lanky dark man is back at my bedside. His name is Farid, I remember now. And with him is a child from the car. His face reminds me of the sound of bells. I'm thirsty. I fade out. I keep fading in and out. The name of the man with the Clark Gable mustache turned out to be Dr. Farooqi. He wasn't a soap opera star at all, but a head and neck surgeon, though I kept thinking of him as someone named Armand in some steamy soap set on a tropical island. Where am I wanted to ask, but my mouth wouldn't open. I frowned, grunted. Armand smiled. His teeth were blinding white. Not yet, Amir, he said, but soon, when the wires are out. He spoke English with a thick, rolling Urdu accent. Wires? Armand crossed his arms. He had hairy forearms and wore a gold wedding band. You must be wondering where you are. What happened to you? That's perfectly normal. The post-surgical state is always disorienting, so I'll tell you what I know. I wanted to ask him about the wires. Post-surgical? Where was Aisha? I wanted her to smile at me, wanted her soft hands in mine. Armand frowned and cocked one eyebrow in a slightly self-important way. You are in a hospital in Peshawar. You have been here 2 days. You have suffered some very significant injuries, Amir, I should tell you. I would say you are very lucky to be alive, my friend. He swayed his index finger back and forth like a pendulum when he said this. Your spleen had ruptured, probably and fortunately for you a delayed rupture, because you had signs of early hemorrhage into your abdominal cavity. My colleagues from the general surgery unit had to perform an emergency splenectomy. If it had ruptured earlier, you would have bled to death. He patted me on the arm, the one with the IV, and smiled. You also suffered 7 broken ribs. One of them caused a pneumothorax. I frowned, tried to open my mouth, and remembered about the wires. That means a punctured lung, Armand explained. He tugged at a clear plastic tubing on my left side. I felt the jabbing again in my chest. We sealed the leak with this chest tube. I followed the tube poking through bandages on my chest to a container half filled with columns of water. The bubbling sound came from there. You also suffered various lacerations. That means cuts. I wanted to tell him I knew what the word meant. I was a writer. I went to open my mouth, forgot about the wires again. The worst laceration was on your upper lip, Armand said. The impact had cut your upper lip in 2, clean down the middle. But not to worry. The plastics guys sewed it back together, and they think you will have an excellent result, though there will be a scar. That is unavoidable. There was also an orbital fracture on the left side. That's the eye socket bone, and we had to fix that too. The wires in your jaws will come out in about 6 weeks, Armand said. Until then, it's liquids and shakes. You will lose some weight, and you will be talking like Al Pacino from the first Godfather movie for a little while. He laughed. But you have a job to do today. Do you know what it is? I shook my head. Your job today is to pass gas. You do that, and we can start feeding you liquids. No fart, no food. He laughed again. Later, after Aisha changed the IV tubing and raised the head of the bed like I had asked, I thought about what had happened to me. Ruptured spleen, broken teeth, punctured lung, busted eye socket. But as I watched a pigeon peck at a breadcrumb on the windowsill, I kept thinking of something else Armand or Dr. Farouki had said. The impact had cut your upper lip in two, he had said. Clean down the middle. Clean down the middle. Like a hair lip. Farid and Zohrab came to visit the next day. Do you know who we are today? Do you remember? Farid said, only half jokingly. I nodded. Alhamdulillah, he said, beaming. No more talking nonsense. Thank you, Farid, I said, through jaws wired shut. Armand was right. I did sound like Al Pacino from The Godfather. And my tongue surprised me every time it poked in one of the empty spaces left by the teeth I had swallowed. I mean, thank you for everything, I said. He waved a hand and blushed a little. Bas, it's not worthy of thanks, he said. I turned to Sohrab. He was wearing a new outfit, a light brown pirhan tomban that looked a bit big for him, and a black skullcap. He was looking down at his feet and toying with the IV line coiled on the bed. We were never properly introduced, I said. I offered him my hand. I am Amir. He looked at my hand, then to me. You're the Amir Agha father told me about, he said. Yes. I remembered the words from Hassan's letter. I have told much about you to Farzanajan and Sohrab, about us growing up together and playing games and running in the streets. They laugh at the stories of all the mischief you and I used to cause, he had written. I owe you thanks too, Sohrabjan, I said. You saved my life. He did not say anything. I dropped my hand when he didn't take it. I like your new clothes, I mumbled. They're my son's, Farid said. He has outgrown them. They fit Sohrab pretty well, I would say. Sohrab could stay with him, he said, until we found a place for him. We don't have a lot of room, but what can I do, he said. I can't leave him to the streets. Besides, my children have taken a liking to him, huh, Sohrab? But the boy just kept looking down and twirling the line with his finger. I've been meaning to ask, Farid said, a little hesitantly. What happened in that house? What happened between you and the Talib? Let's just say we both got what we deserved, I said. Farid nodded and didn't push it. It occurred to me that somewhere between the time we had left Peshawar for Afghanistan and now, we had become friends. I've been meaning to ask something too, I said. What? He replied. I didn't want to ask. I was afraid of the answer. Rahim Khan, I said. He's gone, Farid replied. My heart skipped. Is he... No, just gone, Farid said. He handed me a folded piece of paper and a small key. The landlord gave me this when I went looking for him. He said Rahim Khan left the day after we did. Where did he go? I asked. Farid shrugged. The landlord did not know. He said Rahim Khan left the letter and the key for you and took his leave. He checked his watch. I'd better go. Be a Sohrab. Could you leave him here for a while? I said. Pick him up later. I turned to Sohrab. Do you want to stay here with me for a little while? He shrugged and said nothing. Of course, Farid said. I'll pick him up just before evening namaz. There were three other patients in my room. Two older men, one with a cast on his leg, the other wheezing with asthma, and a young man of 15 or 16 who had had appendix surgery. The old guy in the cast stared at us without blinking, his eyes switching from me to the Hazara boy sitting on a stool. My roommates' families, old women in bright shalwar kameezes, children, men wearing skull caps, shuffled noisily in and out of the room. They brought with them pakauras, naan, samosas, and biryani. Sometimes people just wandered into the room, like the tall bearded man who walked in just before Farid and Sohrab arrived. He wore a brown blanket wrapped around him. Ayesha, the nurse, asked him something in Urdu. He paid her no attention and scanned the room with his eyes. I thought he looked at me a little longer than necessary. When the nurse spoke to him again, he just spun around and left. "How are you?" I asked Sohrab. He shrugged and looked at his hands. "Are you hungry? That lady there gave me a plate of biryani, but I can't eat it," I said. I didn't know what else to say to him. "Do you want it?" He shook his head. "Do you want to talk?" I said. He shook his head again. We sat there like that for a while, silent, me propped up in bed, two pillows behind my back, Sohrab on the three-legged stool next to the bed. I fell asleep at some point, and when I woke up, daylight had dimmed a bit, the shadows had stretched, and Sohrab was still sitting next to me. He was still looking down at his hands. That night, after Farid picked up Sohrab, I unfolded Rahim Khan's letter. I had delayed reading it as long as possible. It read like this. "Amir John, inshallah you have reached this letter safely. I pray that I have not put you in harm's way and that Afghanistan has not been too unkind to you. You have been in my prayers since the day you left. You were right all those years to suspect that I knew. I did know. Hassan told me shortly after it happened. What you did was wrong, Amir John. But do not forget that you were a boy when it happened. A troubled little boy. You were too hard on yourself then, and you still are. I saw it in your eyes in Peshawar. But I hope you will heed this. A man who has no conscience, no goodness, does not suffer. I hope your suffering comes to an end with this journey to Afghanistan. Amir John, I am ashamed for the lies we told you all those years. You were right to be angry in Peshawar. You had a right to know. So did Hassan. I know it doesn't absolve anyone of anything. But the Kabul that we lived in those days was a strange world, one in which some things mattered more than the truth. Amir John, I know how hard your father was on you when you were growing up. I saw how you suffered and yearned for his affections, and my heart bled for you. But your father was a man torn between two halves, Amir John, you and Hassan. He loved you both, but he could not love Hassan the way he longed to, openly and as a father. So he took it out on you instead, Amir, the socially legitimate half, the half that represented the riches he had inherited and the sin with impunity privileges that came with them. When he saw you, he saw himself and his guilt. You are still angry, and I realize it is far too early to expect you to accept this. But maybe someday you will see that when your father was hard on you, he was also being hard on himself. Your father, like you, was a tortured soul, Amir John. I cannot describe to you the depth and blackness of the sorrow that came over me when I learned of his passing. I love him because he was my friend, but also because he was a good man, maybe even a great man. And this is what I want you to understand, that good, real good, was born out of your father's remorse. Sometimes I think everything he did, feeding the poor on the streets, building the orphanage, giving money to friends in need, it was all his way of redeeming himself. And that, I believe, is what true redemption is, Amir John, when guilt leads to good. I know that in the end, God will forgive. He will forgive your father, me, and you too. I hope you can do the same. Forgive your father if you can. Forgive me if you wish. But most importantly, forgive yourself. I have left you some money, most of what I have left, in fact. I think you may have some expenses when you return here, and the money should be enough to cover them. There is a bank in Peshawar. Farid knows the location. The money is in a safe deposit box. I have given you the key. As for me, it's time to go. I have little time left, and I wish to spend it alone. Please do not look for me. That is my final request of you. I leave you in the hands of God, your friend always, Rahim. I dragged the hospital gown sleeve across my eyes. I folded the letter and put it under my mattress. Amir, the socially legitimate half, the half that represented the riches he had inherited and the sin with impunity privileges that came with them, Rahim Khan had written. Maybe that was why Baba and I had been on such better terms in the U.S., I wondered, selling junk for petty cash, our menial jobs, our grimy apartment, the American version of a hut. Maybe in America, when Baba looked at me, he saw a little bit of Hassan. Your father, like you, was a tortured soul, Rahim Khan had said. Maybe so. We had both sinned and betrayed. But Baba had found a way to create good out of his remorse. What had I done, other than take my guilt out on the very same people I had betrayed, and then try to forget it all? What had I done, other than become an insomniac? What had I ever done to right things? When the nurse, not Aisha, but a red-haired woman whose name escapes me, walked in with a syringe in hand and asked me if I needed a morphine injection, I said yes. They removed the chest tube early the next morning, and Armand gave the staff the go-ahead to let me sip apple juice. I asked Aisha for a mirror when she placed a cup of juice on the dresser next to my bed. She lifted her bifocals to her forehead as she pulled the curtain open and let the morning sun flood the room. "Remember now," she said over her shoulder. "It will look better in a few days." My son-in-law was in a moped accident last year. His handsome face was dragged on the asphalt and became purple like an eggplant. Now he is beautiful again, like a Lollywood movie star. Despite her reassurances, looking in the mirror and seeing the thing that insisted it was my face left me a little breathless. It looked like someone had stuck an air pump nozzle under my skin and had pumped away. My eyes were puffy and blue. The worst of it was my mouth, a grotesque blob of purple and red, all bruises and stitches. I tried to smile and a bolt of pain ripped through my lips. I wouldn't be doing that for a while. There were stitches across my left cheek, just under the chin, on the forehead, just below the hairline. The old guy with the leg cast said something in Urdu. I gave him a shrug and shook my head. He pointed to his face, patted it, and grinned a wide, toothless grin. "Very good," he said in English. "Inshallah." "Thank you," I whispered. Farid and Sohrab came in just as I put the mirror away. Sohrab took his seat on the stool and rested his head on the bed's handlebars. "You know, the sooner we get you out of here, the better," Farid said. "Well, Dr. Farooqi says," I began. "I don't mean the hospital, I mean Peshawar," Farid said. "Why?" "I don't think you'll be safe here for long." He lowered his voice. "The Taliban have friends here. They will start looking for you." "I think they already may have," I murmured. I thought suddenly of the bearded man who had wandered into the room and just stood there staring at me. Farid leaned in. "As soon as you can walk, I'll take you to Islamabad. Not entirely safe there either. No place in Pakistan is, but it's better than here, At least it will buy you some time.
Farijan, I said, this can't be safe for you either. Maybe you should not be seen with me. You have a family to take care of.
Farid made a waving gesture.
My boys are young, but they're very shrewd. They know how to take care of their mothers and sisters.
He smiled. Besides, I didn't say I would do it for free.
I wouldn't let you if you offered, I said.
I forgot I couldn't smile and tried.
A tiny streak of blood trickled down my chin.
Can I ask you for one more favor? I said.
For you, 1,000 times over, Farid said.
And just like that, I was crying.
I hitched gusts of air, tears gushing down my cheeks, stinging the raw flesh of my lips.
What's the matter? Farid said, alarmed.
I buried my face in one hand and held up the other. I knew the whole room was watching me. After, I felt tired, hollow.
I'm sorry, I said.
Sohrab was looking at me with a frown creasing his brow. When I could talk again, I told Farid what I needed.
Rahim Khan said they live here in Peshawar, I said.
Maybe you should write down their names, Farid said, eyeing me cautiously, as if wondering what might set me off next. I scribbled their names on a scrap of paper towel, John and Betty Caldwell.
Farid pocketed the folded piece of paper.
I will look for them as soon as I can, he said.
He turned to Sohrab. As for you, I'll pick you up this evening. Don't tire Amir Agha too much.
But Sohrab had wandered to the window, where a half dozen pigeons strutted back and forth on the sill, pecking at wood and scraps of old bread. In the middle drawer of the dresser beside my bed, I had found an old National Geographic magazine, a chewed-up pencil, a comb with missing teeth, and what I was reaching for now, sweat pouring down my face from the effort, a deck of cards. I had counted them earlier and surprisingly found the deck complete. I asked Sohrab if he wanted to play. I didn't expect him to answer, let alone play. He had been quiet since we had left Kabul. But he turned from the window and said, "The only game I know is Panchpar."
"Well, I feel sorry for you already, because I'm a grandmaster at Panchpar, world-renowned," I said.
He took his seat on the stool next to me. I dealt him his 5 cards.
"When your father and I were your age, we used to play this game," I said,
"especially in the winter, when it snowed and we couldn't go outside. We used to play until the sun went down."
Sohrab played me a card and picked one up from the pile. I stole looks at him as he pondered his cards. He was his father in so many ways. The way he fanned out his cards with both hands. The way he squinted while reading them. The way he rarely looked a person in the eye. We played in silence. I won the first game, let him win the next one, and lost the next 5 fair and square.
"You're as good as your father, maybe even better," I said after my last loss.
"I used to beat him sometimes, but I think he let me win."
I paused before saying, "Your father and I were nursed by the same woman."
"I know," he said.
What did he tell you about us?" I said.
"That you were the best friend he ever had," he said.
I twirled the jack of diamonds in my fingers and flipped it back and forth.
"I wasn't such a good friend, I'm afraid," I said. "But I'd like to be your friend. I think I could be a good friend to you. Would that be all right? Would you like that?"
I put my hand on his arm, gingerly, but he flinched. He dropped his cards and pushed away on the stool. He walked back to the window. The sky was awash with streaks of red and purple as the sun set on Peshawar. From the street below came a succession of honks and the braying of a donkey, the whistle of a policeman. Sohrab stood in that crimson light, forehead pressed to the glass, fists buried in his armpits. Ayesha had a male assistant help me take my first steps that night. I only walked around the room once,
one hand clutching the wheeled IV rack, the other clasping the assistant's forearm. It took me 10 minutes to make it back to bed, and by then, the incision on my stomach throbbed, and I had broken out in a drenching sweat. I lay in bed, gasping, my heart hammering in my ears, thinking how much I missed my wife. Sohrab and I played Panchpar most of the next day, again in silence, and the day after that. We hardly spoke, just played Panchpar, me propped in bed, he on the three-legged stool, our routine broken only by my taking a walk around the room or going to the bathroom down the hall. I had a dream later that night. I dreamt Asif was standing in the doorway of my hospital room, brass ball still in his eye socket. "We're the same, you and I," he was saying. "You nursed with him, but you're my twin." I told Armand early that next day that I was leaving. "It's still early for discharge," Armand protested. He wasn't dressed in surgical scrubs that day, instead in a button-down navy blue suit and yellow tie. The gel was back in the hair. "You are still on intravenous antibiotics and," he began. "I have to go," I said. "I appreciate everything you've done for me, all of you, really. But I have to leave." "Where will you go?" Armand said. "I'd rather not say." "But you can hardly walk." "I can walk to the end of the hall and back," I said. "I'll be fine." The plan was this: leave the hospital, get the money from the safe deposit box and pay my medical bills, drive to the orphanage and drop Sohrab off with John and Betty Caldwell, then get a ride to Islamabad and change travel plans, give myself a few more days to get better, and fly home. That was the plan, anyway, until Farid and Sohrab arrived that morning. "Your friends, this John and Betty Caldwell, they are not in Peshawar," Farid said. It had taken me 10 minutes just to slip into my Pirhan Tombon. My chest, where they had cut me to insert the chest tube, hurt when I raised my arm, and my stomach throbbed every time I leaned over. I was drawing ragged breaths just from the effort of packing a few of my belongings into a brown paper bag. But I had managed to get ready and was sitting on the edge of the bed when Farid came in with the news. Sohrab sat on the bed next to me. "Where did they go?" I asked. Farid shook his head. "You don't understand." "Because Rahim Khan said," I began. "I went to the U.S. consulate," Farid said, picking up my bag. "There never was a John and Betty Caldwell in Peshawar. According to the people at the consulate, they never existed. Not here in Peshawar, anyhow." Next to me, Sohrab was flipping through the pages of the old National Geographic. We got the money from the bank. The manager, a paunchy man with sweat patches under his arms, kept flashing smiles and telling me that no one in the bank had touched the money. "Absolutely nobody," he said gravely, swinging his index finger the same way Armand had. Driving through Peshawar with so much money in a paper bag was a slightly frightening experience. Plus, I suspected every bearded man who stared at me to be a Talib killer sent by Asif. Two things compounded my fears. There are a lot of bearded men in Peshawar, and everybody stares. "What do we do with him?" Farid said, walking me slowly from the hospital accounting office back to the car. Sohrab was in the back seat of the Land Cruiser, looking at traffic through the roll-down window, chin resting on his palms. "He can't stay in Peshawar," I said, panting. "Nay, Amir Agha, he can't," Farid said. He had read the question in my words. "I'm sorry, I wish I..." "That's all right, Farid," I said. I managed a tired smile. "You have mouths to feed." A dog was standing next to the truck now, propped on his rear legs, paws on the truck's door, tail wagging. Sohrab was petting the dog. "I guess he goes to Islamabad for now," I said. I slept through almost the entire 4-hour ride to Islamabad. I dreamt a lot, and most of it I only remember as a hodgepodge of images, snippets of visual memory flashing in my head like cards in a Rolodex. Baba marinating lamb for my 13th birthday party. Soraya and I making love for the first time, the sun rising in the east, our ears still ringing from the wedding music, her henna-painted hands laced in mine. The time Baba had taken Hassan and me to a strawberry field in Jalalabad. The owner had told us we could eat as much as we wanted to, as long as we bought at least 4 kilos. And how we had both ended up with belly aches. How dark, almost black, Hassan's blood had looked on the snow, dropping from the seat of his pants. Blood is a powerful thing, Bachim. Khala Jamila patting Soraya's knee and saying, God knows best. Maybe it wasn't meant to be. Sleeping on the roof of my father's house. Baba saying that the only sin that mattered was theft. When you tell a lie, you steal a man's right to the truth. Rahim Khan on the phone telling me there was a way to be good again. A way to be good again. If Peshawar was the city that reminded me of what Kabul used to be, then Islamabad was the city Kabul could have become someday. The streets were wider than Peshawar's, cleaner, and lined with rows of hibiscus and flame trees. The bazaars were more organized and not nearly as clogged with rickshaws and pedestrians. The architecture was more elegant too, more modern, and I saw parks where roses and jasmines blossomed in the shadows of trees. Farid found a small hotel on a side street running along the foot of the Margala Hills. We passed the famous Shah Faisal Mosque on the way there, reputedly the biggest mosque in the world, with its giant concrete girders and soaring minarets. Sohrab perked up at the sight of the mosque, leaned out of the window and looked at it until Farid turned a corner. The hotel room was a vast improvement over the one in Kabul where Farid and I had stayed. The sheets were clean, the carpet vacuumed, and the bathroom spotless. There was shampoo, soap, razors for shaving, a bathtub, and towels that smelled like lemon. And no bloodstains on the walls. One other thing. A television set sat on the dresser across from the 2 single beds. Look, I said to Sohrab. I turned it on manually, no remote, and turned the dial. I found a children's show with 2 fluffy sheep puppets singing in Urdu. Sohrab sat on one of the beds and drew his knees to his chest. Images from the TV reflected in his green eyes as he watched, stone-faced, rocking back and forth. I remembered the time I had promised Hassan I would buy his family a color TV when we both grew up. I'll get going, Amir Agha, Farid said. Stay the night, I said. It's a long drive. Leave tomorrow. Tashakur, he said. But I want to get back tonight. I miss my children. On his way out of the room, he paused in the doorway. Goodbye, Sohrab John, he said. He waited for a reply, but Sohrab paid him no attention. He just rocked back and forth, his face lit by the silver glow of the images flickering across the screen. Outside, I gave him an envelope. When he tore it, his mouth opened. I don't know how to thank you, I said. You've done so much for me. How much is in here? Farid said, slightly dazed. A little over $2,000. 2,000, he began. His lower lip was quivering a little. Later, when he pulled away from the curb, he honked twice and waved. I waved back. I never saw him again. I returned to the hotel room and found Sohrab lying on the bed, curled up in a big C. His eyes were closed, but I couldn't tell if he was sleeping. He had shut off the television. I sat on my bed and grimaced with pain, wiped the cool sweat off my brow. I wondered how much longer it would hurt to get up, sit down, and roll over in bed. I wondered when I would be able to eat solid food. I wondered what I would do with the wounded little boy lying on the bed, though a part of me already knew. There was a carafe of water on the dresser. I poured the glass and took two of Armand's pain pills. The water was warm.